You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. The gender of Wisconsin's Civil War Eagle, Old Abe, has been up for debate for a century. New evidence puts the matter to rest. We'll get the full story coming up.
First, it's the second day of the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. Last night, Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark gave a speech in support of presidential nominee Donald Trump and the police. And this morning, Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish spoke to the Wisconsin delegation, though she had given up her delegate position because of a scheduling conflict.
Sean Johnson has the latest. He's reporting all week from the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. He'll be on Central Time every day this week to give us an update on what's happening there.
Sean Johnson is WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Veronica.
Well, Sean, in general terms, what is day two like so far?
Day two has been a bit quieter than day one so far. I mean, by this point yesterday, we'd had that kind of delegate fight on the floor where they're shouting over each other. In the Wisconsin delegation, you'd had a speech from Paul Ryan. So far today, people have really been talking a lot about what happened last night with the Melania Trump speech over and over again. So that's been the topic of the day. The speaking program, though, is going to get set pretty soon, get started pretty soon over at the convention hall. And then you'll see the formal nomination process for Donald Trump begin, and followed by a number of speakers, including two Wisconsin speakers, Paul Ryan and Ron Johnson.
And Sean, let's talk a little bit about Sheriff Clark first, before we get to the talk of the day, which is the Melania Trump and Michelle Obama speeches that people are talking about. So last night, Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark talked. He spoke. What did he say?
Yeah, Sheriff David Clark is, just to set it up a little bit, I mean, he's not just known to people in Milwaukee by any means. He's very active presence on cable news, Fox News in particular, and so I think the people, when he got up to speak, knew who they were seeing. I mean, this is somebody who's familiar to the Republican diehards that were in attendance at the convention. So he got, really, at that point in the evening, probably the biggest round of applause for the night. And then when he gave a line about Blue Lives Matter, it's just the biggest round of applause thus far that night. People stood and cheered, and he pretty much had the crowd eaten out of his hands at that point.
And you sent us a little bit of the audio. Here's Sheriff Clark.
We can have all the fights we want in this room. We can have all the fights we want at this convention. But keep this in mind. When you leave Cleveland, one team, one goal. And that is to defeat Mrs. Bill Clinton.
An applause line there for Sheriff Clark, Sean. And I know you tweeted at one point that you thought he had gotten one of the biggest applause lines of the night. What did he say at that point?
So that was the Blue Lives Matter, the line that was at the convention last night that got the big applause. The line that you just heard there was to the Wisconsin delegation breakfast this morning, where he went a little bit longer than he did before the full convention hall last night. And he said that he wasn't initially all that excited to get up and speak for Donald Trump, and that the Trump campaign reached out to him, and he decided it was the right way to go because he feels like Trump is better than Hillary Clinton.
And we have one more bit of audio of Sheriff Clark, and talking about here Donald Trump's style.
I just admire his smash mouth brand of politics. He kind of reminds me of myself.
Short clip there, but Sean, put that into context for us. When did that get said?
Yeah, I mean, that was after his speech today, and I think it kind of affirmed what people sort of had this hunch about going into this convention. I mean, Donald Trump likes to get personal with his political foes. David Clark, it's definitely the same. And so there you heard an affirmation from David Clark himself that he kind of likes that about Donald Trump. He called it smash mouth.
We're talking right now with WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief, Sean Johnson. He is in Cleveland at the Republican National Convention. And, Sean, you started by talking about some of the controversy that came up after the Melania Trump gave a talk, and people identified it, bits of it, not all of it certainly, but some of it as having quite a bit of similarity to a speech from Michelle Obama. And Lieutenant Governor Clayfish weighed in on that as well. What did she say?
Yeah, so the speech, if you listen to a couple passages, really, they're nearly word for word between what Melania Trump is saying and what Michelle Obama was saying in 2008. I guess last night, this was being pretty widely reported as just strictly plagiarism. Today, the Trump campaign is saying it was not that. We're not backing down from it. This was spoken from the heart from Melania Trump. Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish had this to say when asked what she thought about that passage of the speech.
You know, what we heard was that she put her heart and her soul into the sentiments that she expressed last night. And out of the 35 minutes, there were a couple of similarities. And the similarities were that she had hopes and dreams for the children of America, that she believed in her husband and his belief in this country. Well, I would hope that anyone who would be the future First Lady of the United States would say things like that.
That was Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clayfish. And Sean, we've been talking about these two speeches, and you sent us some so we can hear them a bit side by side. This audio is being played a lot today. Here's a little bit of Melania Trump and Michelle Obama.
The values that you work like, hard for what you want
hard
in life.
For what you want in life.
That your word is
that
your bond.
Word is your bond. That you do what you say you're going to do.
Keep your promise.
That you treat people with dignity and respect, and because
we want
our children and all children in this nation to know that the only limit to the height of your achievements is the reach of your dreams and your willingness to work hard for them.
And that's the audio heard around the world this morning. Different versions of that going around. But are those reverberations still being felt today, Sean? Or is there a sense that that was last night? We've got a fresh day ahead.
I would just say that we're still in that news cycle, since not a lot new has happened at the convention, and that was, made for pretty compelling video, pretty compelling audio, that has been discussed a lot today at convention. So, you know, perhaps we'll move on from it tonight, but it's definitely fresh on people's minds right now.
And tonight, maybe some more news there. Tonight's another big night for Wisconsin Republicans. Senator Ron Johnson is speaking. What do you know about what he might be speaking about?
All we know is that they're going to be talking about the economy tonight. And we know what Ron Johnson has said about Donald Trump in the past. He's kind of hinted that he likes Donald Trump while never fully embracing Trump. I mean, remember, Ron Johnson is a vulnerable incumbent senator. You look at all the Republicans incumbents that are up for election this cycle. He is probably the most apt or second most apt to lose his seat, and he faces a re-election battle against Russ Feingold, who had the seat until 2010 when Ron Johnson beat him. So this will be interesting, if for no other reason than Ron Johnson is now fully embracing Donald Trump in a very public way. I think you could probably imagine he's going to talk about his own private sector background and how that's something that he likes with Donald Trump.
And Sean, it sounds like House Speaker Paul Ryan is also going to talk at the convention tonight. What is he expected to talk about?
Again, it's the theme is the economy, and so I think he's probably going to be along those lines. Paul Ryan's remarks earlier this week, actually it was yesterday, to the Wisconsin delegation breakfast were pretty boilerplate. This is what House Republicans are up to. And it was notable in that speech that he never even made reference to Donald Trump. It was all about this is what House Republicans are doing. This is the vision that we've articulated to lead. There was nothing about, and we're going to need somebody in the White House to do that with us. So he's speaking to the full convention tonight. You would imagine he would have to frame that differently. But, Paul Ryan does give some of those people who are uneasy about Trump someone to latch on to. I mean, in that he's someone who said, I don't support everything that Trump says, but I'm willing to endorse him anyway.
And Sean, just briefly before we let you go, seeing reports of something else happening at the Republican National Convention, norovirus outbreak there. This is the thing that people get on cruise ships, I guess, the stomach flu. Are you feeling okay, and are you seeing this having an impact? It's not a pleasant virus to get.
Yeah, I feel fine, but I did see that news report and read it with some interest. A very quickly spreading virus with very uncomfortable sounding symptoms. So, you know, other than what I'd read here and there, haven't seen any signs of that, but I hope I don't.
Well, I hope you and everybody else stay well. Sean, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was Sean Johnson, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He joined us with the latest from the Republican National Convention. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, will Donald Trump be able to capture working voters in Rust Belt states like Wisconsin? National pundits, some of them say yes, our guest says no, and stop calling us a Rust Belt state.
First, an eagle from Chippewa Falls has gone down in history under the nickname Old Abe. Old Abe joined the 8th Infantry Regiment from Wisconsin during the Civil War. He went to war with the regiment and was even wounded in battle.
Over the years, a mystery around Old Abe gathered steam. The question, was Old Abe a boy or a girl? Stories going back years and years charged that Old Abe was actually a female all along, and he, or I guess she, if this is correct, had been known to lay eggs.
The Wisconsin Veterans Museum finally put that question to rest with the help of the University of Wisconsin Biotechnology Center Molecular Archaeology Group, and they recently unveiled their findings. Michael Telsrow joins us now. He's the director of the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. Michael, thanks a lot for joining us.
Good afternoon. Pleasure to be here.
Well, Michael, how long has this mystery about whether Old Abe was a male or a female eagle been kicking around?
Well, you know, it's a fascinating story. During the war, it was generally accepted by most of the guys in the regiment that the bird was a male. There were a few fellows who said no, and they referred to the bird as she, most prominently a guy named Armitage with the regiment. But, you know, it was a juvenile bird. It was not full grown, and there's no way to tell the sex of a bird, of a bald eagle, unless you actually examine it. So it's highly unlikely any of the guys in the regiment did that or would have known how to do it in any case. So that kind of goes on, but really what happens after the bird's death, after Old Abe's death, Lily Devereaux Blake, who of course is the famed suffragette, starts referring to Old Abe as she and claims that she or others had seen the bird lay eggs. And this caused a huge uproar with the veterans who said, absolutely not, there's no way. This was a male bird through and through. You're besmirching his memory. And it appeared in newspapers throughout the country with headlines like slander, base and vile, who says Old Abe laid eggs, and that sort of thing. And it really got a lot of attention throughout the country. And we found that just to be fascinating. I mean, there's the story, the wartime story of the bird, which frankly doesn't matter whether it's a male or female. It did what it did. But this post-war controversy that erupts in 1889 and again in 1915, it just won't go away. So we had the feathers and we thought, well, let's settle this question once and for all.
Well, let's tease out the answer just a little longer here. You have these feathers. Now, there's a long path from a Civil War eagle to feathers in your possession today. Can you trace that out a little?
Yeah. That is, you know, we were fortunate that we had feathers with a very, very strong provenance and a very strong record of custody. So really what happens is, of course, the bird, if you know much about the history of Old Abe, dies in 1881, is stuffed, mounted, put back in the Capitol, and then perishes once and for all in the 1904 fire. And that fire takes most of the Civil War relics that were deposited in the old GAR Memorial Hall. That's the Grand Army of the Republic, the Union Veterans. So they put out a call, a statewide call, to replenish the museum. And among the artifacts that were sent in for inclusion in the new museum were feathers from Old Abe. Now, these came from a number of pretty solid sources. We tested four feathers, three of which came from a gentleman who actually was a handler of the bird and who was in close contact with the bird. He had since passed on, and they were donated by his surviving spouse. And the other feather, one of the larger wing feathers, came directly from Governor La Follette. So those were given to the GAR Museum. They were immediately put in what we would call a shadow box with notations about who donated the feathers, when they were donated, and they remained in that box until we removed them for testing in March of 2016.
And how did that testing work? You've got these feathers. You're reasonably sure that these are, in fact, the feathers of old apes. So what happens next?
Well, again, we had to make sure they were, in fact, feathers. We know they're bald eagle feathers. We know that. So we went through, you know, several different attempts to get someone to do the work. We thought we had somebody out in New Mexico that would do it, but that didn't work out. There were some other places we looked at. But finally, we were sort of directed to the UW and by a colleague at the Milwaukee Public Museum. And we turned those over to the Molecular Archaeology Group in March. They did their testing, and they test for a series of chromosomes and combinations. And so they were able to come to a definitive answer about the sex of the bird.
Talking to Michael Telsrow, director of the Wisconsin Veterans Museum, looking at the history of old Abe, Civil War Eagle with a Wisconsin regiment, a mystery, controversy down through the ages since the Civil War. Was old Abe male as originally thought or female as a counter theory proposed? Let's look at the history a little bit of old Abe. We got to the high tech stuff, Michael, but how did this eagle end up being this regimental mascot, I guess, standard?
Well, it was captured by a couple of Ojibwe tribal members. It was an eaglet. There was another eaglet in the nest with it. Now, there's two stories. One is this fella climbed the tree and retrieved the bird. The other is that he chopped the tree down. The eaglets fell to the ground. One of them was killed, and he took the surviving one. So we're not totally sure how that played out. In any case, it was subsequently sold to a farmer in the Eau Claire region, and then sold again to members of the militia company that was organizing to be included in the 8th Regiment, and that's the origin of the bird and its journey to becoming one of the most famous military mascots of the Civil War. Now, I might add, there was another as a footnote, another eagle that served with the 49th. Wisconsin Regiment for a very short time. That was a golden eagle. But so old Abe did accompany the 8th through more than 30 battles. Was at the big battle at Vicksburg, and when time came for the regiment to reenlist in 1864, the guys in the regiment said, "Old Abe's had enough. We're gonna send the bird back to Madison, where he lived out the rest of his life in the confines of the Capitol."
One of the things that to me was really fascinating about the story was that he wasn't just a mascot. I mean, as you said, he went to battle, but it sounded like the Confederate troops were literally
targeting. Right.
Well, they were very scared of the eagle. Huh. He instilled terror in them. Is that true?
It is true. Well, he of course, symbol of not only of this particular regiment in battle, but symbol of the Union. This eagle, and the story is that he would often come free from his tether with the color guard and then fly above the Confederate troops, screeching and diving and so forth. And there are stories that Confederate General Sterling Price had offered a bounty for anyone who could shoot the Yankee buzzard. Of course, that didn't happen. But so it has a wonderful, colorful wartime history. And, just to think about a bald eagle going into battle is fascinating. Mm. It's hard to imagine this bird at the head of the troops with the color guard under fire surviving the war.
Well, those feathers survive down today to this day. Four feathers. We have good reason to believe they really are from old Abe. As you said, they went to the Biotechnology Center. Let's get to the verdict. What did they find?
Well, I've probably given it away already, but they tested for the presence of two male sex chromosomes, which is ZZ, or both a male and female chromosome, which is ZW, and it came back consistent with the Z chromosome, none matching the W chromosome. So the team was able to conclude that the feathers originated from a male bird.
So you're pretty sure about this. There's not a lot of room for error.
Well, we looked at the evidence against that. We looked at the contemporary accounts of those very few people. There's a very, very small minority who believed during the war that the bird was female. And then we looked at the evidence, post-war evidence as well, And there just didn't seem to be anything beyond the sort of anecdotal kind of, you know, I saw the bird lay eggs, and then there would be a whole host of people saying that's an outrageous lie. The bird never laid eggs. There's no photographs of the eggs. There's no evidence that it ever did.
What about the taxidermist?
Well, the taxidermist, I'm glad you brought that up. But the taxidermist, of course, was charged in 1915, was charged with creating another version of Old Abe. Now, he did not have an example to work from. He did not have an example of Old Abe to work from, since Old Abe had burned up in the fire. He knew that the bird was generally accepted to be a male, so he made a smaller eagle, and someone allegedly commented and said, well, that's very small. Old Abe was larger, and he replied, well, of course, the male of the species is smaller than the female, so therefore, he seemed to be giving credence to the argument that the bird, in fact, was a female. But again, I mean, there's anomalies in the size, so that's another bit of sort of interpretive evidence that we felt was not conclusive. A comment from a sort of an offhand comment from a taxidermist who was recreating a bird. He was probably told recreate a male eagle, and he did what they asked him to do.
So now, with this genetic test in place, do you think we're putting this one to rest now, Michael? We're not going to see flare-ups in the newspapers in another 10,
well,
15
you know,
years?
It's funny. We've already been challenged.
Wow.
So I had to laugh. I thought, you know, maybe this controversy will never come to rest.
Who challenged you?
We had a challenge from a historian in the Eau Claire region who cited Armitage and perhaps put out, you know, cast some doubt on the legitimacy of the feathers. But, you know, there's something to say about the feathers. These, of course, were donated to the JR Memorial Hall by veterans themselves, in some cases wives of veterans. And they held those sorts of relics and objects as sacred. So it's extremely unlikely that someone would willingly or knowingly put forth, you know, counterfeit eagle feathers. We don't know where people would find other eagle feathers anyway, but so we think those, you know, short of actually, and I said this before, short of actually plucking the feathers ourselves from Old Abe, this is as close as we're going to get to 100%.
Michael, thank you so much. It's a fascinating story. Michael Telzer, director of the Wisconsin Veterans Museum, talking about the mystery surrounding the Wisconsin Civil War eagle, Old Abe.
More coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up tonight on the Ideas Network, join us starting at 7 for NPR's ongoing coverage of the Republican National Convention, the speeches, the issues, and the controversies. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, one of the big questions in this presidential race has been, can Donald Trump get Democratic voters to cross party lines and vote for him? Trump made that case during the primary campaign. Here he is talking to Don Lemon. This is last fall on CNN.
Me, more than anybody else, I'll go across lines. I think I'll have a lot of Democrats. You know, Reagan had Democrats for Reagan. It was a very big group of people and a very big block.
I think I'll have a lot of Democrats
for Trump. I think I will have a lot of Democrats voting for me, far more than any Republican for the last long period of time.
Our next guest says it's becoming conventional wisdom that Trump could lure working class Democratic voters in key Midwestern states, what some people call the Rust Belt, and that includes Wisconsin. But he says the Trump campaign shouldn't be too quick to count those votes.
Paul Fanlon joins us now. He's editor and executive publisher of The Capital Times. His piece on Rust Belt politics is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Robin, Veronica, it's really great to be back with you.
Well, are we seeing a lot of this kind of analysis saying, hey, Donald Trump is going to win over these voters in the so-called Rust Belt?
We really are. In my column, which ran a couple of weeks ago, I cited several major pieces, and they were from mainstream prominent publications like the New York Times, The Atlantic, The Economist. And just yesterday, the Wall Street Journal had an opinion piece by a Republican strategist headlined Trump's Best Path to Victory, and it outlined that Rust Belt strategy. So it really has become a conventional wisdom in the national press over the last 2 or 3 months, I think.
And what's the thinking behind that? Why are these analysts saying that Trump has such appeal in places in the Midwest?
Well, part of it is that our minority populations are not as large as they are in some parts of the country. So Trump has apparently a very big appeal with particularly white men without a lot of education who are angry and feel they've been left behind by the global economy, and that's, you know, sort of the relationship to the term Rust Belt, that there's this concentration of these kind of folks. And when we're talking about the Rust Belt, we're mostly talking about Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, where the big numbers of electoral votes are in a presidential election. So that's where I think it primarily grows from.
Now, before we get to your problems with that argument itself, you don't even like the phrase Rust Belt, especially as applied to us here in Wisconsin. Why not?
Well, I really don't. I take offense at it, and I think that people on both sides of the political aisle would take offense at it. Last month, a friend of mine, Dave Cheslevich, who served as 2 terms as Madison's mayor, now writes a column for the local Alternative Weekly, complained about the use of Rust Belt and sent me an email saying that I ought to join him, and I eventually did and mentioned it. I think it's demeaning and not descriptive of who we are. The Upper Midwest has, as we all know and most of your listeners know, lots of diversity, and it's not limited to struggling areas of Detroit or Gary or Cleveland, but it's much different than that. And the term really took hold. I did a little research on it, a little online research. It really took hold in the 1980s when manufacturing collapsed. The manufacturing economy in the country really collapsed. And, of course, an awful lot of that major manufacturing was concentrated in those upper Midwestern states.
But you say this is how the East Coast looks at us here in flyover country in a lot of ways.
I think it is. Yes, I think another thing too that I didn't mention in the column, and it's a little bit off point, but I think it's useful for this discussion, and that's what I think is the national media's tendency to create what oftentimes are false narratives, that you really can't, as media is incented to write about conflict, write about movement, write about what's new. And Hillary Clinton has not a huge lead nationally, but a lead, and even in the so-called Rust Belt states, tends to lead. But there's an incentive, I think, by national media to want to make the race closer or to do what I call false equivalencies in terms of analyzing the race and covering the race. So I think there's a problem with that, too. I think that because the Rust Belt scenario is pretty much arguably Trump's only path to winning the White House, I think it gets more attention than it might otherwise if there were other paths for him to get the White House. If I could segue into my major problem with the Rust Belt analysis, it's as if they think that there's an angry white male cohort that doesn't have a lot of education, that really identifies with Donald Trump, and they're going to come out. Some of them haven't voted before, and they're going to come to the polls in huge numbers. But a lot of times that seems to ignore the opposite effect that Donald Trump has on women, particularly educated women, to offset that. The most recent Marquette University Law School poll, for example, has Clinton with a 38% advantage among white college-educated women, which is mind-boggling. It compares to 13% for Clinton 4 years ago. So, and the analysis that showed up in one of the pieces I read, and I also got into this a little bit more, is the notion that the Republican, well, you know, let's go back to the fact that Trump lost Wisconsin to Ted Cruz 48-35, that the traditional Republican Wisconsin did not embrace Donald Trump's approach to things, but also that even if Trump runs much more strongly than Republicans of the past among working class folks throughout much of the small communities and rural Wisconsin, he's likely to run much less strongly in the affluent suburbs of Milwaukee and other suburbs, suburban areas around the metropolitan areas in the state. So I think the analysis looks at one side. I also think there's a tendency for these national reporters to come into our region and see only those who are out for Trump in a primary race and infer that that's much more broadly what our population looks and thinks like.
Talking to Paul Fadland, editor and executive publisher at the Capital Times, looking at Rust Belt politics in states like Wisconsin. He doesn't like the phrase Rust Belt, but how things will play out for Donald Trump, whether he has, as many national analysts say, a shot at winning in states like Wisconsin. Paul, let's look at Donald Trump's message and how it looks to the communities that these analysts are talking about. He is not generic Republican, as they sometimes put in polls. He's focused on immigration, the wall, talk about Muslims, talk about terrorism, things like that. And in these national analyses you're looking at, people are saying, oh, that's going to resonate with these disaffected white workers in places like Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, elsewhere.
Yeah, Rob, as you know, I think I've been around watching and covering, observing and involved in state politics for more than 35 years. And while there are ideological pendulum swings in how we vote in this state, I just don't see the appeal of that beyond. Certainly there's an appeal to the certain cohort, but I don't see that appeal growing very much from where it's already been. Trump is also very strongly anti-trade, which puts him in direct conflict with a lot of traditional Republicans in the state. So it's a complicated conversation and a complicated message.
And look at Republicans here in the state, many of whom opposed leading Republicans who opposed Donald Trump in that primary election. They backed, they really converged around Ted Cruz in that race. How do you see their efforts to support Donald Trump? A lot of people endorsing him, but it seems awkward.
Yeah, it's tepid. Their support is tepid at best. It's hard to imagine the Republicans in the state providing a lot of outside support. I think Trump's best hope is that he creates he and Sanders both talked about creating a revolution, that there's a whole new type of voter who is motivated to come out to register and come out and shock the world. But I do not see the Republican establishment being enthused, and I think a lot of them are looking beyond this election to determine how the Republican Party in Wisconsin and nationally in the future reconstitutes itself.
Talking to Paul Fadland from the Capital Times, his piece on Donald Trump and working voters in the Midwest is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think that Donald Trump has a shot in battleground states in the Rust Belt, even states that might usually go for Democrats in the presidential election? Does he have a chance of winning here in Wisconsin? And has his campaign swayed you to vote for or against him and the Republican Party this fall? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you in just a moment here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with Paul Fadland from the Capital Times. He says there's widespread speculation that Donald Trump will bring in working class voters in so-called Rust Belt states, maybe like Wisconsin. He says that's mostly wrong.
You can join in at 800-462-1234. Are you a usually Democratic voter thinking of voting for Donald Trump, or a usually Republican voter thinking of not voting for him? Do you consider Wisconsin a Rust Belt state? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page, where we've got a link to Paul's piece, by the way. We will go to our callers now. We've got Jim on the line in Rice Lake. Jim, hi.
Hi, thank you for having me. I appreciate your guest comments. I think that people forget that, you know, Wisconsin has voted Democratic all the way back to Dukakis, so it is a strongly Democratic leaning in presidential politics. My question is, I agree with the guest comments about, you know, the unlikelihood of a Trump victory, but what if these police shootings continue? Hopefully, and we pray that they won't, but if they could, that not be a game change, you know, driving angry, frightened white voters into the Trump camp? In short, could we have 1968 all over again?
Jim, thanks for the call. That or continued terrorist attacks. Mm-hmm. Some people have pointed to dramatic terrorist attacks. What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, I remember 1968. I was old enough to really follow it, and I think it's an excellent question by the caller. I think that the surround right now is really, really difficult between the domestic events and international terrorism. But I also think that as the campaign goes along, there'll be a tendency to look and say, okay, well, what does that mean? I've written a piece that hasn't been published yet. So the Republican convention was about law and order last night. So what does that mean? Does that mean more police with heavier arms, military-type arms? And is that going to discourage a single deranged person from making an attack? The international attacks in Nice last week was one person. So building a war, cracking down, whatever that means, on Muslims. It just seems to me that I think you can make the case, Hillary Clinton will be making the case, that all you'll be doing is to, by that rhetoric and then strong action, is to foster more recruitment of people who might be tending toward terror. It's not like any time in my lifetime in terms of the threat. The threat can be on an individual level, and all the tough talk and arm waving, and I think that's a case that can be made over the next few months. That do I really want to risk kind of the future of the country and the world with this rhetoric, which may feel good, but what's behind it? And I think we'll get more of that as the campaign goes along. It's a good question.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to John in Eau Claire. John, hi.
Hello.
What do you think?
I personally think that both the Republican and the Democrat have ignored the American people long enough. I think the American people need to band together and vote anything independent. I mean, literally anybody that's running independent, just to get that message across that we're done with the games that they play in the top.
John, thanks a lot for that call. Frustration with both parties there, and people have pointed toward that kind of frustration for the unexpected success of Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side, for the unexpected and greater success of Donald Trump on the Republican side.
I actually, in many respects, agree with the caller. I don't think the Democratic Party over the last few years has been particularly strong or effective. The Democrats would say that President Obama has been handicapped by a recalcitrant Congress. But I think the future, and I wrote this in the column, but, you know, prescriptively, I think we need investment in infrastructure, in education and job training, tax incentives, adequate safety nets, for individuals, and we need to finance it with a tax system that recognizes growing wealth disparities. That isn't, but this is a year that has been rewarding more of the kind of voice that last caller provided, which is anger and let's blow it up and figure out how to put it back together later. And so that is a wild card in this year. I acknowledge that.
John, thanks for that call. Paul, in our last couple of minutes, I want to throw you a bit of a curveball. Polarized politics, polarizing election, Wisconsin, big partisan divide here. Mm-hmm. Is it possible for someone from either party to come in with some kind of unifying message in the state and get elected or win the electoral votes of Wisconsin while they're doing it?
Well, probably most of your listeners can guess that I'm going to say the person who's best positioned to do that is Hillary Clinton by the kinds of actions around infrastructure and job training and education that I just talked about. So a competent, experienced kind of leadership that, frankly, I think President Obama has demonstrated throughout the last 8 years. So I think that can happen. I do think a question for another show down the road is within the state, in state politics, how can we come back together? Because we are very far apart.
Yeah, you mentioned the pendulum swinging back and forth, but in a way, we're almost all swinging on our own pendulums right now. They're not even on the same string anymore.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, I couldn't have imagined a Republican Party that would go through the 17 candidate, debacle or spectacle that we've seen over the last year or so. But the Democratic Party is also has its issues that way and doesn't have, you know, beyond Hillary Clinton, who are the next generation of leaders. We've created, through the culture, through social media, we've created a surround. I was having lunch today with a very experienced Democratic operative, and he's been talking to potential candidates for governor. People kind of like the concept of running, but then they look at the personal cost and the toxicity, and it's puts them off.
Well, something for us to talk about again in the future. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
It was really fun. Thank you both.
We've been talking to Paul Fanland. He's editor and executive publisher of the Capital Times. There's a link to his piece on Rust Belt politics. You can find that over at the Central Time Facebook page.
A public hearing tomorrow night in Sheboygan Falls will look at a controversial golf course the Kohler Company wants to build along Lake Michigan, including in a state park.
Neighbors of the proposed site continue to raise concerns. They question a draft environmental impact statement that the Wisconsin DNR recently released. Chuck Kornbach filed this report.
This beach in the town of Wilson, just south of Sheboygan, is a popular place for locals to walk dogs and enjoy the water. But life will change here if the Kohler Company gets the approval to build a 250-acre golf course on lakeshore property the firm owns. Town resident Claudia Bricks co-founded the Friends of the Black River Forest, a group opposing the golf course. Bricks says she's concerned about lake and groundwater contamination, increased traffic, and the removal of many trees.
They want to bulldoze down at least 50%, our estimation is 60% of the trees. And I'm wondering, where's all the wildlife going to go? The Wisconsin Society of Ornithology has said don't do that because that area is a major resting place for the flyways that come through this area.
Bricks also says the federal government has found thousands of Native American artifacts on the site. Bricks is Caucasian, but says she doesn't like the idea of disturbing Native history.
There's a possibility of those Indian mounds or those artifacts or any of that to be unearthed and re-earthed, if I may use that word. I think I would be really upset about that.
Kohler Company Golf Group Director Jim Richardson says his firm is working with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers on the artifacts. He says the state's recent draft environmental impact statement doesn't put up any stop sign.
The archaeological findings don't prevent the development of the project. We're very, very respectful of the archaeological findings.
Richardson says a green light for the golf course would benefit the region.
Well, it's opportunity first to open up private property that we've owned for 75 years and open that up to public use. You know, the minimalist design of the golf course will really give an opportunity for the public to enjoy that property.
Kohler also owns two other golf course complexes in the area, Whistling Straits and Black Wolf Run, which have hosted major championships. Richardson says he thinks there's a market for another course, one that will create hundreds of construction and maintenance jobs. He says he doesn't think tourism at nearby Kohler Andre State Park would suffer, even though the course would require a 4-acre easement into the public land.
It's in an area that currently is not used by the public. It's adjacent to an existing maintenance facility that the park uses, and the existing trails that a lot of the local community utilizes. None of those trails would be impacted by the 4-acre easement.
But the opposition group, the Friends of the Black River Forest, isn't buying Kohler's arguments. The group is even raising money for a potentially long legal fight. At the Handlebar Saloon in Sheboygan a few weeks ago, more than 100 people paid their way in for booyah soup, bands, and to blast Kohler's plans. Jean Zabrowski says she doesn't know why the state has issued the draft environmental impact statement without seeing a formal proposal from the company.
So it's hard for us to understand why we're using our taxpayer dollars to investigate and research and look into this project.
DNR spokesman James Dick says his agency felt it best to go ahead with the Environmental Impact Statement, or EIS, process, saying the DNR has legal authority to do so. Dick says the department will use public comments from the Wednesday night hearing in Sheboygan Falls and other information to prepare the final EIS. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.